So we are continuing our study here in Romans chapter 7, and this is message number 30 in this series entitled The Great Deception. And we'll be looking at Romans chapter 7, verses 7 to 12. What shall we say then? Is the law sin? God forbid. Nay, I had not known sin, but by the law. For I had not known lust, except the law had said, Thou shalt not covet. But sin, taking occasion by the commandment, wrought in me all manner of concupiscence. For without the law, sin was dead. For I was alive without the law once, but when the commandment came, sin revived, and I died. And the commandment which was ordained to life I found to be unto death. For sin, taking occasion by the commandment, deceived me, and by it slew me. Wherefore the law is holy, and the commandment holy, and just, and good. When I first began working as a draftsman, I was quickly introduced to someone whose job was to be the checker. And so I quickly found out the checker was someone who had had long experience in the business, and it was their job to check your work. And so, much like you would experience in school, you would turn in a drawing and you would receive it back with all kinds of red marks all over it, representing all the mistakes that you had made. One of the older draftsmen I had learned from told me, he said, you always hate your checker. Just always hate the checker. And I could see why. It was a little frustrating, but it just sort of became a challenge to me to produce a drawing with no errors. I wanted that drawing to come back with no red marks whatsoever. And I can remember times I would work and work and work, and I'd think, I have produced the perfect drawing. And I would turn it in, and it would come back, and the checker would tell me, I had to bleed all over it. Red marks all over the place. Mistakes, things I'd left out, things I'd gotten wrong. But to my eyes, before I turned it in, it looked like it was perfect. But when the eyes of an expert was laid on that, all sorts of imperfections were found. And that's sort of the way that we encounter the law from the Old Testament. Our lives, by our own eyes and standards, and maybe even by the eyes and standards of others around us that know us, may seem to be pretty perfect. We might seem to be without flaws. However, when examined under the light of the law, always imperfections and flaws and faults and failings are going to be found. We want to consider what Paul has to say about the law in this passage today. He begins chapter 7 to address this issue of the law that will carry on throughout this chapter. And by law here, he means the Old Covenant law or the Mosaic law. In other words, not just the Ten Commandments, but the whole law, all 613 commandments of the law, particularly contained in the books of Exodus through Deuteronomy. Now, the relationship of the Christian to the law was something that was debated throughout the New Testament. In fact, we saw a good bit of that in the book of Acts when we went through the book of Acts earlier. We're seeing it again here in Romans as Paul is coming to certain points in his argument and he's raising these questions and he's answering them. But really, it seems to come up in just about every book in the New Testament, seems to be have something to say about it. And this is a debate that has continued for 2,000 years, and we probably aren't going to settle it today, but we're going to give it a good shot. No, it's probably really something that's going to go on until Jesus returns. There's a lot of confusion and a lot of extremes that abound in relation to the law and what is the relationship of the Christian today to the law and so on. There are some today on sort of one end of the spectrum that call themselves New Testament Christians or red letter Christians. And some mean by that that they've essentially set aside the entire Old Testament. It has nothing to say to us. We just follow the New Testament. There are some that try, on the other end of the spectrum, to go under the law completely. They have Saturday services, for instance, and oftentimes they even will wear prayer shawls and will try to observe feasts and things that are spelled out in the Old Testament. And there's some that would go that route. There are many that are sort of somewhere in between the two, sort of bouncing back and forth with a little bit of this and a little bit of that thrown together. Some try to cling to the law in some way, and one way that they do that is to divide the law into three categories. They'll say, well, the law of God has civil laws, and it has ceremonial laws, and it has moral laws. And we're no longer under the civil and ceremonial laws, but we're under the moral laws of God. Well, one of the problems with that view is the fact that the Bible itself never divides the law into those three categories. You won't find that anywhere in the Scripture itself. And if you actually start studying the law in detail, you will quickly realize that the law cannot be divided that neatly into those three categories. You have a lot of laws that are going to seem to fall under each of the categories, and you just, it doesn't work. It may be a helpful tool in terms of studying the law, just simply trying to break it down maybe into some categories. But in terms of us being under the law, it's again, it's just something the Bible never does or never says. So think about some of the statements that Paul has made about the law in this letter to the Romans so far. In Romans 2:12, he said that sinners will be judged by the law. He said in chapter 2, verses 17 and 23, that the Jews rest in the law and they boast in the law, even though they break it. In chapter 2, verse 25, he basically has said that breaking the law undoes whatever good was done in the law. In chapter 3, verse 19, he spoke about how the law stops all mouths before God and makes the whole world guilty. In chapter 3 and verse 20, he said that no one will be justified by the works of the law. And then he goes on to say that the law brings the knowledge of sin. In chapter 3, verse 21, he said that there is righteousness of God apart from the law. Chapter 3, verse 28, that a man is justified apart from the works of the law. In chapter 4 and verse 15, the law works wrath. In chapter 5 and verse 20, the law made the offense of Adam to abound. And in chapter 6 and verse 14, he said that believers are not under the law, but under grace. So if we think about all of these statements that Paul has made about the law, as we start into chapter 7, Paul is further explaining that not being under the law means having died to the law. Very similar to what he said about sin in chapter number 6. He says believers have died to the law so that they can be joined to Christ and to bring forth fruit unto God through the newness of the Spirit. He illustrated his point in the beginning of chapter 7 by appealing to the law concerning a woman that was married to a husband. And once her husband died, she was no longer under the law concerning her husband. In other words, death had severed that bond. And likewise, he says, the believer has died to the law, severing that bond, that the law, that dominion that bound them, and they've become united to Christ. Paul, in this first part of chapter 7, contrasts the old life where sin works in us, even using the law to bring forth death. And he contrasts that with the new life united to Christ that brings forth fruit unto God through the Holy Spirit working in us. And so that brings us now to this paragraph in verses 7 to 12. And there's a question that Paul raises, and we can understand that question, especially considering all the things Paul has said about the law up to this point. It sounds like Paul is condemning the law. That's what it sounds like if we read all of these things together that he has said. And in fact, reading this, you can understand why that the Jews in that day were accusing Paul and were charging Paul of speaking against the law and against the temple. That's Acts chapter 25, verses 7 to 8, when he was there before Festus in Caesarea, and those Jews came down from Jerusalem. Of course, they couldn't prove their charges. So if we have died to the law, just as we have died to sin, Paul raises the question, is the law sin? Now, Paul addresses this question, and then he goes on to talk about the law throughout the rest of chapter 7, and even the early part of chapter 8 still deals with it some. But Paul's going to end up saying, the law is good. Is the law sin? Paul's going to say, the law is good. But if the law is good, why has Paul said so many negative things about the law? Well, this paragraph is going to help us to understand a number of those issues. So we'll begin here in verse number 7. What shall we say then? Is the law sin? God forbid. Nay, I had not known sin, but by the law. For I had not known lust, except the law had said, thou shalt not covet. All right, so Paul uses his common question, what shall we say then? We've seen him use this, and he's certainly using this form of argument throughout the letter to the Romans. We've seen it thus far. And he's pursuing his argument, and he's raising this question about the law. And again, it's easy to understand why Paul's raising this question, because especially to those Jews that had been listening to Paul for six chapters and all the things that he has said about the law, they're going to want to say, oh, well, shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? Shall we sin because we are not under the law but are under grace? All of these kind of questions that Paul no doubt encountered and maybe even had raised himself in his time before his conversion. So he's raising this question, is the law sin? In other words, Paul, are you condemning the law? Are you speaking against the law? Are you saying that the law is evil? Is it sinful? So he has spoken so negatively about the law. He has associated the law with sin in the last couple of chapters especially. And in verse 5, remember that he had just mentioned, for when we were in the flesh, the motions of sin, which were by the law, did work in our members to bring forth fruit unto death. In other words, he just mentioned how that the law worked in us, worked with the sinful passions of the body to produce death. So this is the question he's raising. Is the law evil? Or is the law in some way responsible for sin? And it almost seems that he could be saying that. Now, Paul, of course, answers with this short, emphatic negative that we've seen before, God forbid, which literally would be translated something like, may it never be, or something along that line. Again, he's indicating the impossibility of that. No, the law is not sin. The law isn't sinful. The law isn't evil. The law isn't responsible for sin. Now, he expands on that answer through these next few verses, and he's referring to the fact that the law gives the knowledge of sin. The law is not sin. The law doesn't cause sin. The law gives the knowledge of sin. Now, he uses a specific example here in verse number 7, and he quotes the 10th commandment that is found in Exodus chapter 20 and verse 17. It's also found in Deuteronomy chapter 5, I believe it is, but thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, nor his manservant, nor his maidservant, nor his ox, nor his ass, nor anything that is thy neighbor's. Thou shalt not covet. He quotes from the law and from the Ten Commandments. He says, I had not known sin, but by the law. For I had not known lust. And the word for lust that he uses is a word that refers to a longing or a desire. It always indicates a very strong desire, but it isn't in and of itself positive or negative. The context will have to determine which it is. But when it is used in a negative context, which it is here, it is a craving desire for what is forbidden. It is a lust is to have a strong desire for that has been prohibited or forbidden to be had. And he uses this example, this commandment, this 10th commandment, which again, choosing that, in a lot of ways, it's ingenious to choose that example because that commandment focuses on what is going on in the heart of a person. So typically when we think about laws, we usually just think about actions, that thou shalt do this and thou shalt not do that. But when you think about the 10th commandment, thou shalt not covet. Now, coveting can certainly be a root of a lot of sins. It could lead to the killing of a neighbor so as to take his property. It could lead to the theft of property from a neighbor. It could lead to adultery in the case of a neighbor's spouse. I mean, all kinds of sins can grow out of covetousness, but covetousness is something that's within. It's not really something that can be seen. It's not really something that can be that you can look at and diagnose. In fact, someone could harbor a covetousness within their heart, never acting on that outwardly, and the truth is the law still condemns them. And in fact, that's what Jesus pointed to in Matthew chapter 5 and verse number 28, demonstrating how that the Jews were not righteous by the law. He referred to looking on a woman who is not your wife with lust, and he called that an act of adultery in the heart. Nothing acted on outwardly, but yet inwardly a sin that leaves you unrighteous and condemned by the law before God. Well, Jesus was correcting their misunderstanding of the law. And similarly, Paul is doing a similar thing here in Romans chapter number 7, by referring specifically to this commandment about coveting. He's saying, I had not known sin or I had not known lust, except the law had said, thou shalt not covet. So the law brought the knowledge of sin, the understanding of sinfulness. And in fact, the very fact that we can sin within our hearts and minds without outwardly breaking some law of God really captures the sinful condition that we are in as human beings. And it also shows us the impossibility of keeping the law to perfection. So Paul is saying he came to truly understand sin and sinfulness because or by or through the law. So Paul and everyone else can see the true nature of sin and the extreme sinfulness of sin. Notice what he goes on to say in verse 8. But sin, taking occasion by the commandment, wrought in me all manner of concupiscence, for without the law, sin was dead. Now, the first thing to notice is he says that sin took occasion of the commandment. So Paul is referring to sin here, which he has done somewhat in the surrounding passages that we've been looking at. He refers to sin as a force that is at work in us. Now, this doesn't, Paul's not removing personal responsibility for sin. He's not saying that sin is just at work in us, and you know we're unconscious of it. We're not responsible. But what he is doing is capturing what it means to be under the dominion of sin. It is to have sin as a power at work within us. When he refers to the command to not covet, Paul says that sin worked all manner of lust in him. And concupiscence, that's a, you know, that's one of those tongue-twisting words. It's an archaic term. Essentially, it's just a word for lust, for strong physical desires. I know, as far as I know, I think that's always negative, that English word is, anyway. But what he's illustrating here is how that the law makes the sinner worse. So if you take a human being that is under the dominion of sin, and you put them under the law, what he's saying is that sin abounds. Sin increases when you take that human being under the dominion of sin and put them under the law. Notice he says, for without the law, sin was dead. What does he mean by that? That sin was dead without the law? Well, he had previously stated in chapter 5, verses 12 to 14, that sin was in the world and death reigned by sin from Adam to Moses. In other words, before the law was ever given at Sinai. So when he says that, for without the law, sin was dead, he can't mean that sin was non-existent. He can't mean that sin wasn't present. It obviously was. That was his point in chapter 5. Before the law was given, sin was in the world and death reigned by sin between Adam and Moses. So when he says that without the law, sin was dead, he's speaking in comparative terms. The word for dead, it can mean inactive or without power, and it can be in the sense that we would think of a dead, lifeless body, but it can mean to be without power or to be inactive. So what he's saying is that before the law was given, sin was in the world and death reigned by sin, but sin did not have its full force as direct, active rebellion against God until the law was given. And that captures again the idea of the word transgress that we talked about back in chapter number 5. And he talks about the transgression of Adam, the fact that he willfully rebelled and disobeyed a direct command by God not to do something. That's not the only thing that is sin, but that is an abounding sin. This direct act of willful rebellion against God. And it was until the law was given that sin didn't have, you could say, its full force or power. Verse number 9. Paul says, for I was alive without the law once, but when the commandment came, sin revived and I died. Now, when we look at verses 9 to 11, Paul's writing in the first person, and he uses the pronoun I, and sometimes it's questionable as to who exactly that Paul is referring to. So Paul says, I was alive without the law once. Well, we turn over to Philippians chapter 3 and verse 5, and we can see that Paul was born under the law, circumcised on the eighth day, he says. So in other words, how could he have been alive without the law? I mean, is he referring to those 7 days from his birth? I mean, you know, how could he be alive without the law? Well, obviously, when you read through the context and you see what Paul is saying, he's speaking of himself, but he is speaking of himself as a Jew. And he's speaking of himself in solidarity with Israel historically. So when he says I, he's speaking of this entire experience, particularly of Israel in the receiving of the law. He says, for I was alive without the law once. You see, Israel, the descendants of Jacob, that is, they existed for a few hundred years before the giving of the law at Sinai. They had grown to become a mighty nation within Egypt before they were delivered out of Egypt and before the law was given to them at Sinai. So when he's talking about being alive and being dead here, we see that he's continuing with this comparison that he is doing. And we might even say that the comparison is perhaps more theological in nature than it is physical in nature. So alive and dead are comparative terms. He says, I was alive without the law once, but when the commandment came, sin revived and I died. So when the commandment came, when the law came, in other words, sin gained power. And that word for revived means to come back to life, to be re-energized, to be reanimated. He says, after the commandment came, which he has spoken of the coming of the commandment or the coming of the law, the adding of the law earlier in chapter number 5. So he's referring to this giving of the law on Sinai. I was alive without the law, but when the law came, sin revived and I died. So the giving of the law confirmed the sinful condition under the dominion of sin and delivered a death sentence in penalty against sin. In a way, you could say that the law came, his sin increased, and his condemnation was sealed against him because of the condemnation of the law and the fact that the law cannot deliver from death. Verse number 10. And the commandment which was ordained to life, I found to be unto death. So the law promised life for obedience. And that's a genuine promise of the law. Absolute, complete conformity to the law. Complete, perfect obedience is rewarded with life. That's according to the law. The problem is that complete and perfect obedience to the law is humanly impossible. It's not possible to do. Because to offend in any one point, we're told, in any one point, to transgress on any point of the law is to offend in all. In other words, it's to have broken it entirely. It's to be guilty of all. It's to inherit the condemnation of the law. That's the ultimate penalty for every transgression of the law. It's the condemnation of death. From what might be considered the least transgression to the greatest transgression. Every sin, every transgression is rewarded with the condemnation of death according to the law. He's already spoken in this letter about how that the breaking of the law in a single point undoes all the keeping of the law. It undoes it all. Jesus told the Pharisees to search the Old Testament scriptures. He said, because in them you think you have eternal life. As in John chapter 5 and verse 39. You see, the law cannot save. But it wasn't given to do that. So the law did not fail in what it was given to do. No, it has accomplished what it was given to do. Paul says, the commandment which was ordained to life, I found to be unto death. So the law was given that promises life for a perfect obedience and conformity, Paul found out to be only unto death because he could never keep it perfectly. And every transgression ends in the condemnation of death by the law. In verse 11, he says, for sin, taking occasion by the commandment, deceived me, and by it slew me. So he's talking about how that sin worked through the law in order to bring death. And you notice that he uses that word deceived. That it deceived me. What is the deceit that Paul is talking about? I believe that he's referring to the deception that Israel labored under. And Paul, for a time of his life, labored under that same deception. When you read Paul talk about the times prior to his conversion, he talks about how that he walked according to the law and the traditions blamelessly. How that he was more zealous for the law above all of his friends and compatriots in serving the law. So the deceit that Israel labored under was in thinking that they could obtain righteousness through the law. That was the deceit. And Paul says that sin deceived me by the law. Through sin, he was deceived to think that through the law, he could obtain righteousness. Now notice carefully what Paul said. The law did not deceive him. Sin deceived him by the law. He was deceived by sin. Israel, as Paul has already spoken of earlier in this letter, Israel boasted in the law. They rested in it. It is the place where their confidence was put. But their breaking of it dishonored God, Paul says. If you remember the earlier part of this letter, that Paul is speaking to how the Jews thought that they were exempt from God's wrath because they had the law. I don't believe that any Jew would have tried to argue that they had kept the law perfectly without any blame or guilt whatsoever. I don't think any would have tried to have argued that. But they thought that the fact that they had received the law, that they were under the law, meant that they were exempted from God's wrath, that they would gain righteousness through the law and inherit eternal life. Yes, that is the great deception that they were laboring under. They were deceived into thinking that. The same law that they boasted in only condemned them to death. And I believe that's what Paul is getting at when he says that he did not know sin until the law had said, "Thou shalt not covet." In verse number 12, "Wherefore the law is holy, and the commandment holy, and just and good." So Paul arrives in verse 12 at his conclusive answer to this question, is the law sin? And he responds, no, the law is holy. The law is just or righteous. And the law is good. And he's referring here, obviously, to the origin, to the source of the law. The law was given by God. I mean, that's where the law came from. Now, I realize that many in Israel's history among the rabbis and what would become the Pharisees and so on, they had traditionally added all sorts of things to the law that did not come from God. But the law itself came from God. It is a revelation from God. It is a revelation of His character. He says it's holy. The law teaches to love God with all of the heart and the mind and the soul and the strength, to be completely consecrated to God. The law teaches holiness, to have no other gods before Him. The law is just. The law teaches to love your neighbor as yourself, to not covet, to not steal, to not kill, to not bear false witness or perpetrate any of these kind of acts against your neighbor. The law is good. Jesus says that the Sabbath was given for man. Man wasn't made to serve the Sabbath. It was a good gift from God. In other words, when you look at the laws pertaining to work and to rest and even laws pertaining to diet and cleanliness, and there was an aspect of these that promote good health and well-being, the law is good. The law was never damaging to someone that followed it. And of course, Jesus fulfilled the law perfectly without sin. Paul says, no, the law is not sin. The law is not evil. The law is not bad. The law is holy and just and good. You see, the problem is not the law. That's not the problem. In chapter 8 and verse number 3, Paul will go on to state that the law was weak through the flesh. It couldn't accomplish what Christ accomplished. That is the salvation, the justification, the righteousness and forgiveness of sins. The law could not accomplish that because the flesh is weak. In other words, the problem is not the law. The problem is with us. The problem is with human beings. The problem is with people who are the descendants of Adam. The law exposes the weakness and the sinfulness of human beings under the dominion of sin. The law itself is not the problem. The problem is that we can't keep it. That's the problem. Even Adam in the garden, who was in a perfect environment, he was in a body without any sin, and even Adam could not keep the commandment of God because he was weak according to the flesh. So no, there's not a problem with the law. Paul's not speaking against the law. He's not condemning the law as sinful or evil. He's not blaming the law as being responsible for our sin. No, the law is good and holy and just. Well, to say that Christians are not under the law, as Paul has said here and as he says in other places as well, to say that Christians are not under the law is not to say that, well, it's all right to just go lust all you want to. That's perfectly fine. I don't really know why it is that our minds seem to go that way. Oh, we're not under the law, then it's perfectly fine to lust then, right? Well, to say that we're not under the law is not to say that the law is of no value or that it has nothing at all to say to us today. I mean, we can't really read Romans or Galatians or Hebrews, these books, and think that's what not being under the law means. But the law itself, we have to understand, was a whole covenant. And I realize that men like to go and slice and dice the law and to pick out little pieces here and there and sort of give it their own interpretation and impose it on everyone else to have to follow. I know that men love to do that. But the law was given as a whole covenant. It's not a buffet. You can't just go choose. I like the illustration that H.B. Charles used. He said, the law, when you come to the law, he said, it's like when you go to eat at Big Mama's house. And when you go to eat at Big Mama's house, you got to eat every bit of her cooking that is put on the plate in front of you. You can't pick and choose. You got to have it all. Well, that's a very good illustration. That's the way that it is with the law. It's not something that we just take what we like and we set aside what we don't like and we sort of tweak it this way and tweak it that way. No, the law is a whole covenant. And what most people mean when they suggest that we are still under the law is that they mean we're under some part of it. But the law is not divided into parts. And whatever the law says, it says to those who are under the law. In other words, in entirety. And to break one point is to be guilty of all. But the law itself is not bad. It is not sinful. But sin will use the law to further enslave us. And the result is only making our transgressions increase. There is no one more deceived than the person who thinks he is righteous in himself. No one is more deceived than a self-righteous person. And if you think you are a good person, and because of the good that you have done, that you will die and go to heaven, well, understand then that you are deceived by sin. If your goodness is brought to the law, you will be shown to be an unrighteous sinner heading for death. Of course, the good news is there is righteousness with God, but only apart from the law and only through faith in Jesus Christ.